They have a lot of clients, big and small, observed Milligan. Bogart added, and most of them have been with Dabney for decades, which doesn't make it easy to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Maybe it's one of the partners,
suggested Jameson, as she went over some pages.
A number of them have been with Dabney since nearly the beginning. He told his daughter, you think you know someone, but really don't. That might apply more to a fellow partner you see every day, rather than a client.
Decker said nothing. He kept going over the files, imprinting all of the information onto his memory. Bogart said, if we interview each of these people and companies, it could take months, maybe a year. And by then, whatever intel was stolen could be used to attack us. Decker still said nothing. He was hearing everything that was being said, but his focus was on the files. Bogart was right. They had to cut this list down somehow. The answer might not even lie in these pages. Dabney might have been referring to someone outside his business. And while Decker believed that the comment Dabney had made to his daughter was connected to all this, he couldn't be absolutely certain of that either. Milligan dropped a file, sat back, and said, I hope we're not whistling in the wind here. Decker glanced over at him, then abruptly rose and left the room. The others didn't notice right away. A few moments later, Bogart said, wait a minute, where did he go? Jameson just looked toward the doorway and shook her head.
You know, I can't really come running every time you call me.
Harper Brown was staring at Decker across the front seat of her BMW. You tend to show up when you want to show up, said Decker, who was in the passenger seat. She ran her fingers over the steering wheel.
Your call was intriguing, I have to admit.
Decker just stared at her, making no move to speak.
You have quite the gift of patience waiting for the other person to speak and maybe slip up.
Decker put his hands over his belly. Do you want to slip up?
Why in the world would you say that?
You seem to have been skirting around the edges ever since you showed up in the middle of this investigation.
It's dinner time. You hungry?
Look at me. I'm always hungry.
I know a burger place,
she said. You don't strike me as a burger sort of person.
You don't really know me yet.
They drove to the place, parked, and walked in. It was a dive, and Decker could smell the lard coming from the kitchen before he passed the first table in the small dining area. They found a semi-private spot near the hall to the bathrooms. When the waitress came, Brown said,
Number 12's for the table, and two especials, just the bottles, save the dishwasher some work.
The woman nodded and walked off. A moment later, they could hear her calling out the order to the cooks in the back. Number 12, said Decker.
Trust me, you'll love it.
She leaned back in her chair, stretched out her long, jean-clad legs, and looked at him.
Slip-ups?
You open the tap and then turn it off. You tease. You play bad, then good. You sort of agree to help, but pull back. You threaten to kick us off the case, but won't or can't make good on it. She shrugged.
Just trying to do my job.
Bogart checked on you with a buddy of his at DIA.
Good for him.
He didn't know you. Never heard of you.
Where is this buddy assigned at DIA? We operate in over 140 locations overseas in addition to a big footprint here.
DISC in Reston.
Defense Intelligence Support Center. He's probably a civvy and a paper pusher. I'm neither. And are you somehow implying that I don't work at DIA?
Your badge and creds look real.
That's because they are.
I'm not saying you're a phony. They never would have allowed you inside Hoover if your creds were fake.
So what exactly are you saying?
Snapped Brown. That you're interesting, and I still don't know what you're actually after.
I thought I made that perfectly clear. Whoever Dabney stole the secrets to, that's who I'm after.
Made any progress? Asked Decker.
What, you're here to try to ride my coattails?
Just interagency cooperation. She smiled and said demurely,
I'm sorry, and I know you've been dancing around this issue, but I don't remember saying that I needed your help.
Everybody needs help once in a while. Their beers came, and they each took a long sip.
So you're here to help me?
She asked, setting her bottle down.
How generous of you.
I don't really care how I get to the truth, so long as I get there. I figured if we combined resources, we might get there faster, instead of running on parallel tracks. Hell, you're the one saying this could lead to an apocalypse. Excuse me for taking you at your word. She took another sip of her beer and then rubbed her mouth with a napkin.
Okay, I get the point. But I did try to explain why I was reluctant to bring others into the loop.
I'm not a damn spy, Brown. I just got to this town a few months ago. Your world is stranger to me than living on Mars would be. But I just want to get to the truth, that's all. She considered this and said,
Okay, where do things stand with your investigation?
We have two angles to exploit. Dabney's end and Berkshire's background.
I told you I'm only interested in Dabney.
But you might be interested in Berkshire, or at least you should be. She looked intrigued.
And why is that?
If someone blackmailed Dabney to kill Berkshire, they could be the same people he sold the secrets to, or someone who knew about it and used it to manipulate Dabney. If that's correct, then that party is looped into this whole espionage circle and could be a national security threat. That's right up your alley. They didn't say another word until their food arrived a couple minutes later. Decker stared down at a double-stacked burger with thick bacon strips, two fried onion rings, and a fried egg topping it all, with a large steak knife drilled right through the middle of it. A giant mound of fries was delivered along with the burger. He looked up from the meal to Brown. You're really going to eat this? You weigh, what, 120? And you look like fat wouldn't dare attach itself to you. She plucked a fry from the stack and bit half off.
Genetic gift of fabulous metabolism. Plus I work out. A little.
Right, a little. They began to eat. She poured ketchup onto a small plate in the middle of the table and said,
Hypothetically speaking, let's say you're right. How would you attack the problem?
Dig on both ends. We met today and discussed going at it from the two angles, like I said. Maybe we get lucky and end up meeting in the middle. She took a bite of her burger while Decker chewed on an onion ring. She said,
Dabney's End has a lot of potential suspects. Guy's had a long career in the industry.
It was suggested that it might be somewhat like strangers on a train. The third party who has a beef against Berkshire gets Dabney to kill their enemy in exchange for their not revealing what he's done. Dabney may have no connection to Berkshire at all.
He obviously had no idea we were already on to him,
said Brown thoughtfully.
Or he would have known that the game was over.
If he had known that, he might not have bothered to kill Berkshire.
Or you could be totally wrong and he did have a connection with Berkshire, only you haven't found it yet.
Perfectly true, said Decker, taking a huge bite of his burger. He dipped a fry into the ketchup, ate it, then wiped his fingers on his paper napkin. But we have to start somewhere. And if that is the case, we should turn that up when we look into their backgrounds, especially Berkshire's.
But you have no leads right now,
she said. We have a clown, said Decker. She had taken a sip of beer and almost spit it out.
Come again?
He told her about the possibility of the clown being the signal for Dabney.
Let's finish up here and go someplace we can talk in private,
she said. Like where?
Like my place.
After they finished their meals and she paid, Harper drove them to a street full of old high-dollar row houses that looked newly renovated. It was a couple blocks off Capitol Hill. She pulled into a space and cut the engine. Decker looked out the car window. Nice area.
Yeah, it is.
She got out and led him to the front steps of a three-story house with a facade of white painted brick with another wing fronted by stone. The door was solid wood and looked about a century old. There was a gas lamp post in the small front yard, which was enclosed by a 3-foot-high wrought iron fence. She opened the door and turned off the alarm. Decker followed her inside. The interior was warm and inviting, the furnishings tastefully selected, the rugs thick and subtly patterned and colorful. The walls were brick in some places, stone in others, and solid plaster in still others. What looked like original oil paintings hung on several walls. Brown led Decker into a small study off a kitchen that was outfitted with stainless steel appliances, granite counters, a pot filler over the Viking range, and cabinets that looked straight out of a Tuscan villa. She poured herself a scotch from a small bar set against one wall and asked Decker if he wanted one. Scotch isn't really my thing. She sat down across from him in a leather wing chair, She picked up a remote on a side table, pressed a button, and a fire burst forth in the stone fireplace situated in the center of one wall. She took off her holster and set her gun down on the table next to her. She slipped off her shoes, curled her legs up under her, and cradled her drink.
"You must be wondering how a federal agent can afford a place like this,"
she said.
"And the BMW."
"Never crossed my mind." She smiled.
"Ever heard of Hewlett-Packard?"
"Me and a few billion other people."
"My great-grandfather was one of the earliest investors in HP, and about six other now Fortune 500 companies. He set up a trust fund. I also inherited money from him. When my parents died, I inherited still more. This house actually belonged to my grandfather."
"Must be nice."
"It is nice. I feel very fortunate."
He eyed the Beretta. "But you obviously didn't take the path of living off of your money and doing nothing else with your life."
"I came by that naturally. My father was military. Maxed out as a full colonel. He was in Vietnam. 2 purples and a bronze. He was a hell of a soldier."
"That's impressive, Agent Brown."
"Just make it Harper. We're off duty, Amos. My father was the reason I joined up. He could have sat back and lived off money he didn't earn, too, but he decided to put on the uniform and serve."
"So you were in the military?"
"Technically, I still am. Army. Did 2 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan."
"What was your job?"
"EOD specialist."
"I don't know what that is."
"Sorry, we tend to talk in acronyms. Explosive Ordnance Disposal Specialist. I defused unexploded bombs and IEDs."
"That sounds dangerous."
"Everything over there was dangerous. It was dangerous waking up, and it was dangerous going to sleep, and it was dangerous for everything in between."
"I can see that. Is that what your dad did in the military?"
"No. He thought I was a nut job for joining the EOD, but I was really good at it."
She took a sip of her drink.
"So, back to the case. You proposed an arrangement of some type?"
"I think working together makes sense, but you obviously wanted to talk in private, which is why we're here." He sat back and eyed her expectantly. She rubbed her bare foot and took a few moments to marshal her thoughts.
"The secrets that Dabney sold were critical to the security of this country. Without going into too much detail, he may have divulged a back door into some of our most important cybersecurity platforms."
"Wait a minute. You told me before that these stolen secrets had to do with tanks and planes and stuff terrorists couldn't afford to build." She sipped her scotch.
"That was before I knew you better."
"So you lied."
"I used a standard tactic to allow me sufficient opportunity to calculate your trustworthiness."
"So you lied," Decker said again.
"But now I'm telling you how it really is. We have unauthorized backdoors into our intelligence platforms."
"Which means they're hackable?"
"Which means they've probably already been hacked."
"But now that you know about the theft, can you take steps to prevent further damage?"
"Easier said than done. The thing is, we don't know precisely when Dabney conveyed the secrets. Thus, whoever he sold them to could have already installed malware or spyware on the systems. We can't shut everything down. And secrets may already have been stolen and national security compromised."
Decker nodded. "I can see the problem."
"No, I don't think you do. I wish they had simply stolen stuff on tanks and planes. That takes a long time to build. This can be used against us immediately. In fact, it may already have been used against us. We could be sitting on a time bomb right now and have no idea where it is or when it's going to go off."
She added coolly,
"What do you think about that?"
"I think I'll take that scotch now." She rose and poured it out for him before settling back down in her chair. Decker took a small sip of the drink and let it burn down his throat. "How do you know exactly what Dabney stole?" he asked. She drank some scotch before answering.
"I have a DIA top secret clearance with an SCI, or Sensitive Compartmented Information, access kicker. Anyone at CIA or NSA with those security clearances from their agencies would not be allowed to know that information, because that's just how our world works. There's no reciprocity on that score."
"Which is your polite way of telling me you can't answer my question." She held up her glass in affirmation of his statement.
"But what I can tell you is that we are satisfied that we're correct in what was stolen. We just don't know who has it or how long they've had it, or what they've done with it.
So how do we work this together?
Can you really remember everything?
More or less. Emphasis on the more.
How many people were in the restaurant tonight?
Decker clicked through his frames. 14, not counting us or the staff.
There was a guy sitting on the right side of the bar. What was he wearing?
Decker told her, down to his sock color. Then he added, "Your odometer reading on the BMW is 24137. Do you want to know your VIN? I saw it the first time you gave me a ride, so I've got that, too." He recited it for her. She grabbed her purse, took out her wallet, slipped out her insurance card, and read out the VIN. Her expression said it all. Decker had been perfect. She sat back.
That's remarkable.
So again, how do we work this? Together.
As I said before, Dabney interests me more than Berkshire. Do you agree?
Decker shook his head. Whoever got Dabney to kill Berkshire blackmailed him to do it. That means they know about the secrets he sold. And I'm betting that they know who he sold them to. It actually might have been one and the same party. We figure out the Berkshire end, then we solve your problem, too. She put down her scotch.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
So you'll work with us on Berkshire? She nodded.
Yes, I will.
Good. I might have some information that will help.
Like what?
Like maybe what Ann Berkshire used to be. Chapter 33. Brown's features froze for an instant.
What she used to be? You care to explain that statement?
It's the reason I called you tonight. She has no past further back than 10 years. But she had a resume showing she graduated from Virginia Tech, only her first name was spelled differently, and she's rich. And we don't know how she came by the money.
Okay, what does that tell you?
I was speculating that she might be a spy. Maybe the one that Dabney passed the secrets to. But then why kill her? And we can find no connection between them. So we considered the witness protection angle. But I don't think any of the people in that program are rich. And she volunteered and worked as a school teacher. That really put her out there in the public eye some. I don't think the U.S. Marshals encouraged that. They have their protectees keep low profiles.
Which leaves what?
She did something on her own that caused her to put together a new identity, and whatever she did in the recent past gave her great wealth.
Don't keep me in suspense, Decker.
It stands to reason that the people who blackmailed Dabney might be in the military arena. Defense contracting, more specifically. That allowed Dabney to have the access to get the secrets, and them to buy the secrets, or at least know he committed treason.
And that is all speculation on your part,
pointed out Brown. Without facts, that's all we can do at this point, but I'm trying to deal in probabilities.
Okay, go on.
I think she could have been a whistleblower. Brown put her feet on the floor and stared at him.
Keep going.
If she was the whistleblower on some defense contract that went sideways, she might have gotten a reward. Sometimes they're tied to a percentage of the amounts saved by the government because of the person's actions. That would explain Berkshire's wealth. She might have gotten some of the people she informed on sent to prison. That would explain why she adopted a new identity, to hide from them.
And those people might be out now,
said Brown. They might be, yes. And maybe some of them didn't go to prison. But her whistleblowing might have ruined their business, caused them to go bankrupt, shut them out of the government feeding trough. That could be a motive to have someone kill her.
Yes, it could. How did you come up with this angle?
Something Todd Milligan said earlier about whistling in the wind.
So what do we do with this information?
We follow it up. We have to look at whistleblower cases.
There are a lot of them.
That's where you come in. I believe this is tied to the defense sector. She nodded and took another sip of her scotch.
You'll need to be read into some things, and you don't have a security clearance, which makes things difficult.
I've applied for one through the FBI. I've taken and passed the polygraph, but they haven't finished the background check on me yet. He added, my past is a little complicated. She gazed keenly at him.
I would imagine it is.
She set her glass down.
I might be able to work something out. I'll call you tomorrow.
Brown dropped Decker off at his apartment and drove away. For a moment, Decker stood there in the darkness, staring up at the windows of the apartment where Danny and his father had lived. Danny Amaya was a year older than Decker's daughter was when she'd been killed. She'd never actually reached her 10th birthday. Her murderer had gotten to her before that could happen. Molly Decker would have turned 12 this year. His wife, Cassie, would have turned 42. They were dead and buried back in Ohio. He was 500 miles from them, farther than he ever thought he would be. 500 miles farther than he thought he ever could be. He sat down on the front steps of the building and stared down at his feet. Though his memory was near perfect, there were many emotional tethers that Decker struggled to recall or even reform in his head. He had once been someone very different, and that was difficult, if not impossible, for most people to come close to understanding. There were many days when even Decker didn't understand it. He knew that he irritated people with his behavior. He knew that he drove Alex Jameson and the others to distraction sometimes. There was a part of him that wanted to do something about this, to let her and others see the person he used to be. But a larger part of him seemed to crush any attempt to enable himself to do this. If it was frustrating for others, it was maddening for Amos Decker. What they failed to fully comprehend was that the hit on the football field had done far more than give him perfect recall and the ability to see things in color. It had forced him into being a different person, as though a stranger's personality and attendant quirks had been superimposed over his own. But now the stranger's footprint was Decker. I am now the stranger. I'm a stranger in my own body. He would sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and wonder not where he was, as many people, confused and muddled by weariness, did, but rather who he was. And sometimes the answer was not all that easy. He stood, turned, and headed inside. It was after 11 now, and he expected that Jameson would be asleep. So when he opened the door to their apartment, he was surprised to see her sitting at the kitchen table, fully dressed. He closed the door behind him.
Where have you been, Decker?
She said quietly. I'm sorry, Alex. I was with Agent Brown. I came up with a theory, and we're going to work together to run it down.
That's great, Decker. Really wonderful.
Decker did not appear to catch the edge to her voice. It had to do with...
The man who forgets nothing,
she said. He looked at her strangely. What? She stood.
But that's not entirely right.
What's not entirely right? He said in a perplexed tone.
That you don't forget anything.
He drew closer. I'm not following where this is going.
Well, then let me enlighten you.
She paused, drew a long breath that seemed to swell her body, and said in a strident tone,
You forgot that we were supposed to have dinner with Melvin tonight. Cotton's on 14th Street, 7:30.
The color drained from Decker's face. Oh, shit, Alex, She pushed on, her voice starting to crack now.
We waited at the restaurant for 2 hours for you. 2 fucking hours, Decker. I called Bogart, I called 911, I called everybody I could think of.
But why didn't you call me?
I did 12 times.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out his phone. He turned even paler. I forgot I turned it to silent.
Forgot something else, huh? Wow, that perfect memory of yours is just going to hell in a handbasket.
Alex, I'm... Tears crept into her eyes.
You can listen to my frantic voicemails later. You'll probably get a real chuckle out of them, you asshole.
Before he could say anything else, she had turned and stormed down the hall to her room. He heard the door slam behind her. Decker looked down at his phone and saw all the missed calls. He sat down at the kitchen table and listened to the increasingly panicked voicemails. Jameson sounded like she was going out of her mind with worry. And with the fact that he had been nearly killed twice recently and had enemies still out there, he could hardly blame her. The old Decker would have gone to her door, knocked, and profusely apologized. The new Decker just sat there, staring out the window at the darkness that was not so nearly as opaque as the one currently residing squarely in his head. Chapter 34. Bleary-eyed, Jameson got up the next morning, washed her face, and walked down the hall to the kitchen to make coffee. She stopped dead when she got to the kitchen.
Have you been sitting there all night?
Decker looked up from his chair. She said,
Decker, it's 7 in the morning. Have you even been to bed?
In answer, he held up his phone. I listened to the messages. All of them. She frowned and leaned against the wall, wrapping the folds of her robe around her because the apartment was chilly.
Okay,
she said slowly. I screwed up, Alex. I'm sorry. I'm sorry you were so worried. And I'm sorry I missed dinner. She came and sat down next to him. She rubbed her eyes and looked at him.
Knowing you, I probably shouldn't have overreacted when you didn't show up. I mean, it's not like it's the first time you've stood me up.
She played with the cord on her robe and added,
but with all that's taken place recently with the Amayas and everything, I just thought something terrible had happened to you.
If you ever call again, I will answer it. And if I don't, then you probably will need to call 911. She gave him a grudging smile, squeezed his arm, and rose to go make coffee.
I called Melvin last night and told him you were okay.
Decker flinched because it had never occurred to him to do this. What the hell is wrong with me? Thanks for doing that.
Maybe we can grab dinner tonight?
She said cautiously. Yes, we can.
Don't be too quick to agree. You might live to regret it.
She brought 2 cups of coffee over and set one down in front of him before retaking her seat.
Now, talk to me about this theory you came up with.
Decker went through it step by step. Jameson looked impressed.
A whistleblower, huh? That would explain a lot of the questions we've got.
The problem will be finding out which whistleblowing case. There have been a lot of them over the years.
But it shouldn't be that hard. We can circulate Berkshire's picture all over. Someone will have to recognize her.
The thing is, Alex, her picture has been all over the place. After the murder, it was on all the news cycles and still is in some places. She took a sip of coffee and looked perplexed.
That's true. I wonder why no one has come forward then.
She changed her name, obviously. She could have changed her appearance, too.
You mean plastic surgery?
There are lots of ways to change your appearance other than going under the knife. She could have lost weight, changed her hairstyle and color, started wearing glasses, or used tinted contacts to change her eye color. It all adds up.
We could ask the ME if Berkshire had had surgery. The autopsy would have shown that.
I emailed her last night. She must be an early riser. She emailed me a half hour ago and said there were no signs of plastic surgery.
Speaking of early risers, don't you think you should get some sleep?
I'm not tired.
Well, at some point you're going to need to rest or else you're going to wear out. You want some breakfast?
I'll get it.
Okay, I'm going to grab a shower.
As she walked off, Decker's thoughts trended back to Berkshire. Specifically to the old house in the woods. The flash drive, he knew, would have been a treasure trove of information. It might have detailed Berkshire's past, answering so many questions. But someone had followed them there, shot out Decker's tire, assaulted him, and taken it. So someone was watching them, or else they had been watching the old house. He heard a buzzing sound and looked down. It was Jameson's phone. He didn't recognize the number, and the caller ID came up as unknown, so it wasn't on Jameson's contact list. He heard the shower running. He could have just let it go to voicemail, but decided to answer it. Hello?
Hello, this is Nancy Billings. I was calling for Alex Jameson or Amos Decker with the FBI.
I'm Amos Decker.
Oh, hi. I'm a teacher at the school where Ann Berkshire worked as a substitute. I understand you might have some questions for me. I'm sorry to be calling so early, but I have to leave for work soon.
No, that's no problem. Could we meet after school?
Yes, I have to go home and let out the dog, but there's a Starbucks near where I live.
She gave him the address and they set a time. He called Bogart and filled him in on what had happened with Agent Brown. Next, he told him about Billings and the meeting later that day. Bogart said, I'll start following up on the military whistleblower angle. I know that's Brown's bailiwick, but I have some contacts there, too. And the FBI investigated, and the DOJ prosecuted a great many whistleblower cases over the years. Decker clicked off and put his phone in his pocket. He went to the bathroom, splashed water on his face, and brushed his teeth. He came out at the same time Jameson did. She was wrapping a scarf around her neck.
Did you eat?
She said. No, slipped my mind.
Wow, the old memory's just crapping out on you,
she said dryly.
That's okay, we can get something on the way into Hoover.
Nancy Billings called. She worked with Berkshire at the school. I've arranged for us to meet her after she finishes at school today.
Hopefully she can tell us something helpful.
When they opened the exterior door to their building, Harper Brown was standing there. She wore jeans, boots, a black turtleneck, and a brown leather jacket. She held up a bag.
Bagels. And I've got coffee in the car.
She glanced at Jameson.
But not enough for you.
Jameson said,
We were about to head out to run down a lead.
Brown looked at Decker.
DIA HQ whistleblower files. You in or out? There won't be a second offer.
Can't Alex come with us? Brown shook her head.
I had a hard enough time getting permission for you to come out. We can't have a tag along.
Jameson bristled at this comment, but said,
Okay, Amos. I'll let Bogart know about this when I get into the office.
I'll fill you all in on everything when I'm done at DIA.
Well, to the extent they're cleared to hear it,
said Brown, staring at Jameson. Staring directly at Brown, Jameson said,
And I'm sure I'll do the same, so long as you're cleared for it.
They drove off, leaving Jameson standing in the parking lot. She shook her head, apparently trying to clear her thoughts.
Maybe I should just go back to being a journalist,
she said to herself. Chapter 35. DIA's sprawling headquarters was at Joint Base Anacostia Bowling. It was located on the east side of the Potomac River and across that body of water from National Airport. The Potomac cut a path northwest, with the far shorter Anacostia River snaking northeast. At the entrance, Decker received a visitor's badge and went through the security protocol. On one wall was the seal of the agency, a flaming torch of gold on a background of black, with a pair of red atomic ellipses encircling a globe. Brown pointed to it and said,
Flame and gold represents knowledge, or intelligence, as we like to call it. The black equals the unknown.
And the red? Asked Decker.
Scientific aspects of intelligence.
Is it that scientific when you're dealing with people?
Maybe more than you know.
They passed a wall with names on it. Decker stopped and stared at it. Brown, who had been walking down the hall, came back to stand next to him.
Torchbearer's wall,
she said.
The people on here have been awarded the highest honor for service to DIA and the country. We also have a memorial wall in the courtyard with the names of the 7 DIA personnel killed on 9/11 during the attack on the Pentagon.
Decker pointed to one name on the list. Colonel Rex Brown. Any relation?
My father,
said Brown before heading off again. Decker fell in step behind her. Think you'll end up on the torchbearer's wall? He said.
I'd rather that than the memorial wall.
What'd your father do to be on the wall?
Classified.
She opened a door and motioned Decker inside. He stepped through and gazed around at 3 walls of computer screens, all alive with pictures, but no sound. Brown closed the door behind her.
We have around-the-clock watch centers everywhere, literally taking in everything of significance going on all over the world. This is just a bit of feed from some of those operations.
Impressive, said Decker, as he sat down in a chair set around an oval conference table. And how does this help us? The door opened, and a man came in. He was about 6 feet tall, with burly shoulders, massive arms and thighs, and close-cropped graying hair. His military camis seemed unable to fully contain his muscular physique, and he wore a scowl.
Agent Brown, he said gruffly.
Colonel Carter,
she said pleasantly.
This is Amos Decker with the FBI.
Highly irregular. Couldn't believe it when I got the email. Man hasn't even passed his FBI security clearance, much less DIA protocols.
The whole case is a bit irregular,
said Brown.
But we feel Decker is vital to getting to the bottom of this.
It's your professional funeral.
Just working a case,
retorted Brown.
and I'll use any asset I have to get to the truth, and Decker is a hell of an asset.
For the first time, Carter looked at Decker, who was wearing the same clothes as yesterday, wrinkled jeans, a stained sweatshirt, and a rumpled windbreaker. His hair was uncombed and jutted out every which way, and he hadn't shaved, so his 5 o'clock shadow was prominent. Carter looked at Brown in disbelief.
What the hell? Does he work undercover at the FBI?
Decker stirred and said, No, but I did brush my teeth for the meeting. Carter stared at him for a few seconds and then slammed his electronic notebook down on the table and sat. Brown slipped into a seat on the other side of Decker and took out a notebook and pen. Carter started tapping keys on his notebook, and the screens on the wall all went dead except for one.
Whistleblowers, he said. Starting from A and going to Z.
He looked at Decker.
There's a lot, so try to keep up.
Do my best, mumbled Decker, staring at the live screen. On the screen there appeared a photo of a man.
Carl Listener, said Carter. From 1986. Military contract with a company we won't be disclosing to Mr. Decker. Listener was the liaison. He found out about certain irregularities and came forward.
Our person's name is Ann, interjected Decker. So do you have any non-males doing the whistleblowing? Carter looked sharply at Brown.
I wasn't given those parameters.
Sorry, Colonel, this was all done in a rush.
Of course it was, which is why this guy is sitting here. And when you rush, you screw up. But that's not my problem. It's yours.
He hit some more keys.
Okay, we have 15 possibilities.
He glanced at Decker.
Aren't you going to write any of this down?
I'm good, said Decker. Carter visibly rolled his eyes, gave Brown a seething look, and turned back to the screen. Hours later, they had run through all of the whistleblower files. Brown turned to Decker and said,
I didn't see anything helpful. Not even any of the peripheral players could be Berkshire.
Decker nodded. He turned to Carter. There's a mistake in your files.
Impossible, barked Carter.
Frame 64 and frame 217. 64 says Denise Turner was stationed in Islamabad in July 2003. Frame 217 says it was Faisalabad. You might want to pick one. Decker got up and walked out. Carter hit some keys and brought up the frames in question.
He was right,
said Brown thoughtfully as she looked at the screen.
Son of a bitch got lucky,
Carter shot back.
Don't believe that for a minute.
She rose. Carter said,
Who the hell is that guy?
Brown stared after Decker.
Still trying to figure that out myself, Colonel.
Chapter 36. Decker was waiting for her outside the room. He leaned against the wall, his hands shoved into his pants pockets. She said,
I think you shook up the good colonel.
Yeah, look, could there be any other whistleblower cases out there? Maybe that no one knows about?
I don't see how. The whole point of being a whistleblower is that you blow the whistle and come forward, so we would have a record of it.
Decker sighed and closed his eyes. Brown said,
By the way, did you spot any other mistakes in there?
9. Nothing substantive, so I decided to let the good colonel find them.
You're a real piece of work. But Carter is also an asshole, so it's no skin off my nose.
So, not a whistleblower, then? Said Decker, opening his eyes.
Apparently not, unless she did something unrelated to the defense sector or DIA. That's possible.
Bogart is looking into that.
So where do we go from here?
Decker looked around. How about you talk to me about your world?
Why?
Why not? She considered this and said,
Okay, follow me.
She led him down the hall and into her office. It was small, utilitarian, and had no windows. And there wasn't a scrap of paper on the desk, just a small laptop. By way of explanation, she said,
We don't like paper much. And we don't like windows, surveillance issues, you know.
She pointed to a chair, which Decker took. She sat behind her desk.
What do you want to know?
What can you tell me?
How about the very beginning? Robert McNamara created DIA when he was SecDef under the Kennedy administration.
McNamara, right. And later he did such a great job managing Vietnam.
I'm just giving you the facts. I'm not providing commentary.
What's your principal role here?
Intelligence gathering. We use HUMINT, H-U-M-I-N-T, to get there, unlike some other agencies.
Human intelligence, you mean? She nodded. Do you operate only internationally?
Why would that make sense when so much of what's going on now happens domestically?
So you operate in this country?
It's no secret.
Have there been changes in how you do things?
Where is this going, Decker?
In the direction of the truth, one would hope.
Whose truth?
Any truth works for me right now.
You saying you don't think I'm telling the truth?
In answer, he pointed to a small poster tacked to the wall behind her. It was a DIA recruitment poster. Decker read off the words printed on it. You speak the language and live the culture. You could be anybody, anywhere. He dropped his gaze to look at her. Are you anybody, anywhere?
I could just say it comes with a territory.
Yeah, you could, or you could go farther than that. Maybe with something more recent than freaking Robert McNamara.
I'm not sure I want to.
Well, since I'm a cop, let me tell you what comes from the territory I occupy. People commit crimes, and the cops track them down and arrest them. It's a pretty linear philosophy, A to B to C.
Not how my world works.
Right. So you want the criminals to blow up the world while you're working some sort of backdoor convoluted spy bullshit maneuver that you can use in your next life? She put her feet up on her desk and leaned back in her chair.
Okay, I see your point.
She gathered her thoughts.
Over a decade ago, DIA requested the ability to recruit U.S. citizens to spy and be informants.
Is that so unusual?
No, but DIA also wanted to do it without having to reveal to said citizens that we were a government agency.
How does that make sense?
It apparently didn't. That language was removed from the bill authorizing the recruitment provision.
So does that mean DIA doesn't do it?
I don't. I can't speak for others.
What else?
In 2008, we got approval to conduct offensive counterintelligence clandestine ops, both domestically and abroad.
How would you do that?
Pretty basic stuff. Planting moles, disseminating disinformation, negatively impacting a country's information systems. You might be interested to know that we coordinate with the Bureau on that last one. Then in 2012, we expanded our clandestine collection efforts.
We took over the Defense Department's HUMINT efforts and beefed up our espionage ops overseas, obviously focusing on the military component.
What's your focus these days?
Nothing too surprising. Islamic terrorists, including ISIL and Al-Qaeda, North Korea, Iran, particularly weapon and nuclear technology transfers, and the Chinese and Russians beefing up their military capabilities.
How about the Russians hacking us to try to influence our politics?
That would be a yes, Decker. Strikes right at the fundamentals of our democracy.
So, a lot of ground to cover.
Which is why we have about 17,000 people working on it.
You talked about planting moles. You guys ever have spies in your ranks? She nodded, and her features turned grim.
All intelligence agencies have. The worst for us was probably Anna Boleyn Monts. Very high-ranking analyst here and very well-respected. It was before my time. Turned out she'd been spying for Cuba for over 20 years, did a lot of damage, and probably cost some people their lives.
Never heard of her.
Not surprising. She was arrested right when 9/11 was going down. That pretty much trumped every other story out there for months.
How'd they nail her?
Good old-fashioned detective legwork. And our cause was helped by the fact that spies stick to basic protocols. Shortwave radio transmissions, encryption software, standard drops in crowded places, zigzags on foreign travel. They were able to piece the puzzle together because of that.
You'd think spies would wise up and try something new or vary their routines. She shook her head.
It's like bomb makers, Decker. I learned a lot about them as an EOD. Once they learn a way to do something, they don't like to deviate from it. It's called a bomb signature. That way they work out all the kinks, and they don't get blown up. But it also helps us identify a particular...
Decker got up from his chair and walked out. Brown jumped up.
Decker? Decker!
She raced after him. Chapter 37.
Wow!
Exclaimed Brown. She and Decker had just entered Berkshire's luxurious condo. Brown looked around in amazement.
You were right about her having money.
Decker didn't respond. He made a beeline down the hall, and Brown quickly followed. He went into the master bathroom and then into the separate toilet closet. He snatched the toilet paper off the wall, slid off the roll, and opened the tube. Damn. There was nothing there.
What did you expect to find?
Asked Brown. He pushed past her, left the bathroom, and moved down the hall. He entered the second bedroom and pushed open the door to the ensuite bathroom. He stared down at the toilet paper roll. He took it off the wall, slid open the tube, and there it was.
A key,
said Brown. Like he said, spies don't like to learn new techniques, like bomb makers.
So she used this device before?
At the cottage in the woods, yeah.
What's it a key to?
Decker looked at it more closely. Could be lots of different things. A padlock, maybe. They left the bathroom, and he perched on a chair in the guest bedroom. He closed his eyes and let the frames roll back and forth. Brown watched him curiously.
Checking the old memory?
He said nothing. A minute later, he opened his eyes and stood. He went out into the hall and over to the broad set of windows that looked out onto the street below. If you had something important that you didn't want to keep here, but you wanted it close, what would you do? He asked.
Put it at a storage place?
There aren't any around here, said Decker, looking out the window. This is too high rent a district for it to make economic sense.
But like you said, she'd want it reasonably accessible.
Yes, she would. Let's go. 20 minutes later, they passed the Catholic school where Berkshire had worked. Decker pointed across the street. Brown looked where he was pointing.
A to Z storage?
And hopefully everything in between. They drove into the parking lot and climbed out of the car. Inside, they showed the woman behind the counter their official creds. She looked up Berkshire's name on the database.
She paid for 1 year in advance, still has a few months to go.
Don't count on her renewing, said Decker. He held up the key. Which unit?
I'm not sure I can allow that without a warrant.
Brown said,
We have reason to believe that Miss Berkshire has been storing explosives in that unit.
Oh, my holy Lord!
Exclaimed the woman.
So before we call the bomb squad, we need to check it out. Or we can wait for the warrant and just hope you and this business don't get blown into the sky.
It's unit 2213,
blurted the woman.
Out that door and to the right. Do you think I should leave the premises? I don't want to die for minimum wage.
I think now would be a great time for you to take a break. Yeah,
said Brown. The woman fled out the door, got into her car, and drove off with a screeching of tires. Decker glanced at Brown. I'm beginning to see you in a whole new light. She smiled but said nothing as they walked to Unit 2213. It was a single unit with a roll-up door. Decker used the key to unlock the thick padlock, then bent down, gripped the door's handle, and pulled the door up. Inside was a single shelf with a solitary box on it.
Looks promising,
said Brown. They walked over and examined the box. It was plain cardboard with no writing on the sides or top. Decker pulled out his pocket knife and slit the tape, unsealing the box. He opened the flaps and looked inside. He started pulling objects out and placing them on the shelf next to the box. What looked like a security badge. A typewritten paper in Cyrillic. An old floppy disk. And a doll. While Brown looked at the paper, Decker examined the doll. Brown said,
This is dated May 1985. It looks to be some sort of official communication from Moscow, the KGB.
You can read Russian?
Along with Chinese and Arabic, and I can hold my own with Korean.
Impressive.
It's part of my job, Decker.
He had been probing the doll with his fingers until something gave and a compartment popped open. Decker looked inside, but it was empty. You can see that there's where the batteries would go.
Okay.
He used the blade of his pocket knife to probe around inside the battery compartment. There was a tiny pop, and the whole battery compartment slid out, revealing a space just behind it. She said,
I'm betting that was not put there by the toy manufacturer.
Decker nodded, and it's big enough for a roll of microfiche, or a microdot, or whatever else they used back then.
How do you know about microdots?
I watched enough old James Bond films. He looked at the floppy disk. Old technology like this. He picked up the security badge. The name that had once been on it had been clipped out, but Decker held it up to Brown. The golden torch with the black background and the red atomic ellipses hugging the globe. DIA seal, Decker said. She wasn't a whistleblower.
She was a spy,
finished Brown. Chapter 38. Decker, Brown, Bogart, Jameson, and Milligan were sitting around a conference table at the WFO, staring at the middle of the table. Sitting there were the items Decker and Brown had found at the storage unit and then placed in evidence bags. All the items had been checked for prints and other forensics, but the tests had come back negative. Bogart picked up the doll and examined the secret compartment. Milligan slid the ID badge over and looked at it. You said you'd checked in Berkshire, or whatever her name really is, never worked at DIA?
That's right,
said Brown.
She would have been thoroughly vetted, undergone a background check, and her prints would have been taken and kept on our database. She's not there.
Bogart put the doll down, cleared his throat, and said, We've checked all of our databases and can find no record of her. If she worked either in a government agency or as a contractor requiring a security clearance, her prints would have been on file. They weren't. Decker sat staring down at his hands. Jameson glanced at him.
What do you think, Amos?
I think the part of the badge clipped out had someone else's name. If it were an RFID badge, said Milligan, referring to radio frequency identification devices, it would be full of the holder's data, unless it had been electronically wiped clean. But it isn't, said Decker. It was obviously issued before that technology was used, at least by DIA. Brown said,
Berkshire could have been the mole's handler. She wouldn't need to be on a database or have a badge to do that. The person on the inside would, of course. But Berkshire could have just managed the asset and collected the intel.
That is far more likely, said Decker. We just have to find out who that person on the inside was. But do you think Berkshire was still acting as a handler? Said Milligan. I mean the old badge, the floppy disk, the 1980s KGB communication. It all dates from another era. Bogart said, That's a good point. She might have retired and decided to do something else with her life.
Good works, you mean?
Said Jameson.
Maybe to atone for what she'd done in the past? But where does the money come in?
Asked Brown.
Handlers are not known to make fortunes, and if she was working for the Russians, why not just go back there when she retired?
Maybe she couldn't, said Decker. They all looked at him.
Why wouldn't she be able to?
Asked Brown. Why would a Russian operative be unwelcome back in Russia? Said Decker.
Because they turned against their country,
answered Brown. Are you saying Berkshire was a double agent? Said Bogart.
I'm saying it's possible she was a spy and then was turned.
But if she was, wouldn't there be some evidence of that? Asked Milligan. Some record?
Well, since we just discovered this possibility now, we have to pose that question to the right people.
If it was over 30 years ago, it might be hard to find the right people to ask, noted Bogart. Decker looked at Brown. You know this world better than we do. Where would you look?
There are lots of intelligence agencies, Decker, with overlap, hundreds of thousands of human assets spread over 200 countries.
So, needle in a haystack,
commented Jameson.
Compounded by the fact that the clandestine community doesn't like to answer questions about anything,
added Brown. And if we ask, they may not tell us the truth anyway, said Milligan.
I wouldn't bet the farm on it,
opined Brown. Bogart said, if she was managing an asset within DIA or another of the intelligence agencies, that asset may still be around. Berkshire might have retired, but that doesn't mean the asset did.
That's true,
said Brown.
But where do you think the money came from?
Asked Jameson. If she turned to our side and helped us out, could the cash have come from there? Asked Decker, looking at Brown.
Depending on the significance of the assistance, but if she were a spy, the basic leverage might have been help us or go to prison, not a penthouse.
But if she wasn't caught but came forward voluntarily, said Decker, maybe she didn't reveal herself as a spy, but rather as a citizen with some special knowledge looking to help. Brown thought about that.
I don't know how likely that would be.
Bogart said, the tricky part is, how do we organize an investigation along these lines? We have four items here, and a dead woman who might or might not have been a spy or a handler or something else. Decker said, the first thing we have to do is find out who Ann Berkshire really is, or was. What the hell do you think we've been trying to do, Decker? Exclaimed Milligan. But we have more to work with now. If she was Russian, that's something that can be checked out. If she was a handler for a spy within the government, that can be investigated, too. We have leads. We just have to run them down.
Bogart said, if she did help out this country and was paid a substantial sum for it, that is something we should be able to track down.
But how does that explain Dabney's killing her?
Asked Jameson.
We know that Dabney stole secrets, but that was very recently.
She looked at Brown.
Do you have anything to show that Dabney and Berkshire were working together?
Brown hesitated.
Oh, for God's sake, you can at least nod or shake your head,
said Jameson in exasperation. Brown shook her head. Jameson turned to Decker.
Okay, so what is the connection?
I don't know, admitted Decker. But if we find the answer to one, something tells me we'll find the answer to all. Brown picked up the security badge.
I can check out when these types of badges were used at DIA. We tend to change them on a regular basis, so that will give us some time parameters.
And she kept that KGB communication for a reason, said Decker. Brown nodded.
And I'm going to read it from one end to the other. It might provide some clues.
And the floppy disk?
Asked Jameson.
Bogart picked it up. It's been a while since any of us have seen one of these. We've had the lab go through it. Whatever was on there no longer is. At least nothing that's intelligible.
Was it Russian?
Asked Jameson.
It was computer ones and twos, replied Bogart. That made no sense.
Decker picked up the doll. Milligan said, you don't expect to get anything from that, surely. Decker rubbed the doll's hair. I don't expect anything. I just go where things take me. His phone buzzed. It was a reminder to him of their meeting with Nancy Billings. Decker stood.
Like right now. Let's go, Alex.
Chapter 39. Nancy Billings was in her late 30s, with light blonde hair, a carefree manner, and a nose ring. When she met them at the Starbucks, she was dressed in jeans and a wool sweater. They ordered coffees and sat at a back table. Decker said, just wondering, can you wear nose rings while being a teacher at a Catholic school?
No. I just wear it in my off hours, still pretty strict in parochial school for teachers and students.
So, what can you tell us about Ann Berkshire?
Asked Jameson.
What do you exactly want to know? I mean, I was stunned to hear what happened to her.
Did you two talk, interact?
We did. She substituted for me a number of times. I was sick some. Had to attend some teacher training, and a couple of other times I had to go out of state to help my mom. My dad has dementia.
I'm sorry to hear that,
said Jameson.
Anne was very good, stuck to the lesson plans, knew her way around the classroom. I never heard any complaints.
But you did interact, said Decker.